back to the Mel Kay Show. Very exciting. One of my favorite guests and yours is back with us today. And it's an exciting time because his book, Untenable, finally came out. Thank you for joining me, Jack Cashel.
Well, thank you for having me, Mel.
Yay, I'm so excited. So the book came out, lots of great reviews. Let's tell the audience a little bit about the book. Everyone knows you. You've been coming on for a couple of years now. But we've been waiting for this because all of your other books are just incredible. And this one is no less. But it's a really important issue right now as we deal with in our faces, finally, people actually talking about affirmative action and what's happened to this nation in terms of race. I was just talking to a guy who's been doing it way longer than even you, is Ward Connolly, and he's been fighting this whole affirmative action. We talked to him this morning, and he is he feels like maybe we're on a post, you know, racial America trajectory, even though they want it the opposite. So let's talk a little bit about the book, why you wrote it, and what why people should be reading it.
Well, you know, Mel, there are literally millions of Americans who were forced out of their homes and their neighborhoods that they loved in the 60s and 70s. And for doing so, they were scolded and shamed by the liberal media. The irony, of course, is that Blacks, Asians, Hispanics, whites all left for the same reason, including Michelle Obama's family. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But only whites were shamed, and they've had to live with this white flight. And the anti-racist cartel tells these stories over and over again about Black women with baby carriages were hired to walk down streets, and they sold house. They went house to house, real estate agents, and scared people into moving because a Black person might move in their neighborhood. And they were dealing with their buddies out in suburbia, and they had been taught. They've been allowed to do this by the federal government, which built highways so whites could flee. I mean, it's pure conspiracy theory. And in researching the book, what I learned, among other things, is that essentially everything we've been told about race in America for the last 60 years is either a half-truth at best or an outright lie. Redlining, lie, divide racist highways, nonsense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, The role of affirmative action, 60 years on now, and we're still not satisfied with it. And meantime, they all avoid the real crux of the issue, which Daniel Patrick Moynihan spelled out in his 1965 report, that unless you fix the Black family, there will never be equity. Their expectations are going to be high, he said, because of the Civil Rights Act and the Great Society and, you know, Brown versus Board of Education and Voting Rights Act, but those expectations will be dashed because of the breakdown in the community, breakdown in the family. And he said there will be no social peace. And he was so exactly right, right?
Yeah.
That was, at that time, Black single parent rates were only about 25%. Now they're about 65%. And the problem is only getting worse.
Yeah, and people don't really pay that much attention to it. This is why not only is your book so important because it does dispel a lot of those myths, but also I am more and more invited to, and I just did an event at a church up in Michigan where these are Black communities. The people that invited me are Black pastors in a great church up there. And these are all middle-class educated people that are offended by what is being said about Black students, Black community.
No, you're exactly right. When you see some of the tweets that came out after the Supreme Court decision last week from their supporters alleged, I mean, Blacks will never succeed. They'll have no chance at success. Of course they do. They've always had a chance for success. So many of them have succeeded wonderfully. You know,
right.
Their numbers may not be forced up as they are now. But then again, if they go to some place where that's in line with their skills, they'll succeed as adults. If they drop out of Harvard after 2 years.
Right.
Or if, like Michelle Obama and Barack was a little more successful in navigating that, but Michelle just held her breath for 4 years to get through Princeton. And it was a wasted experience on her. She had to flee into Black studies. Otherwise, she'd have been failing out. And what a waste. I mean, she's a pretty smart woman.
Yeah.
She could have been whatever she wanted to be instead of a marginal Black studies major, as though the world needed one.
Yeah.
Leaving a city with 1 million black people to go to a town with 500 black people to study black people. Makes no sense.
Well, yeah, that's also like the women's studies thing too. I don't even get that either. And the other thing though, too, about this is it's bleeding over. You and I talked about a long time ago about diversity, equity, inclusion, hiring, and how like now you have to, and it's gotten worse because I've looked into recently, I had on a woman that's exposing a lot of the trans stuff. And we were talking about how the medical schools are now making pass fail. You used to have to get like certain grades to even pick a specialty in medical school or to get into a residency. And now that all pass fail, you know, we go all the way down to elementary school. We're talking about social emotional learning. And now with the, as soon as the affirmative action decision came out, then Harvard and other schools, even the administration came out and said that they were going to do a whole of government equity and inclusion in education thing to counter it. So, you know, but like you said, a lot of black voices are saying, well, we don't need that. But it really seems to be white, you know, higher educated liberals that seem to think they do. And I find it incredibly insulting and bad for everyone.
Right. It's sort of the white savior complex, you know. They all see themselves as Atticus Finch, you know, coming to the courthouse and saving poor Tom Robinson. But they're not. They're killing Tom Robinson. They're killing the Mockingbird. It's a shame. It's been going on for 60 years, and it's not getting better. Although the Supreme Court decisions were a breakthrough. Imagine had Hillary Clinton been elected in 2016. Right.
I can't. It's too scary.
Too scary. Just from the Supreme Court perspective.
Yeah. Well, oh God. Can you imagine? I mean, Merrick Garland's supposed to be there and look at what he's doing.
Yeah,
so
honestly. Yeah, right. Exactly.
We would have a total disaster. Now I want to talk because you did write a book about the origins of the Obama family and not just the Obama family, but Obama himself. And I just wanted to real quick just while we're on here, say what Michelle Obama said after the affirmative action thing came down. She says, so often we just accept that money, power, and privilege are perfectly justifiable forms of affirmative action, while kids growing up like I did are expected to compete when the ground is anything but level. So today, my heart breaks for any young person out there who's wondering about what their future holds and what kind of chances will be open to them.
Well, having worked with Joel Gilbert on his film, Michelle Obama 2024, knowing Michelle's story as well as I do, I am just flabbergasted. She has the nerve to say that. What happened is, I'll just trace her academic trajectory because it's worth talking about.
Yes.
She and her family, her first home was a place called Parkway Gardens in Chicago, which when it was built, I think in 1950, was like a marvel of its time. It was a cooperative development for middle-class, upper-class blacks. By the time Michelle was born in 64, they had built projects in the neighborhood. The Element had come into the neighborhood. It had come into the brand new school right down the street from Michelle. So what her mother did was to illegally, it's a Class C misdemeanor, she drove Michelle and her brother Craig to a school 15 minutes away by car in what was a Jewish neighborhood, and still the school still had the vestiges of the excellence that Jews expect from their public schools. And so that's where she went to school. Then as that neighborhood deteriorated, the local high school turned essentially all black. So Michelle's mother took a job so she could send her son Craig, to a Catholic school, you know, that was virtually all white. And even though they're not Catholic, right?
Right.
That's how desperate she was to avoid that kind of education. Michelle, meanwhile, goes to a magnet school in downtown Chicago. It's at least an hour away by bus. She struggles through school. She's not a great student. She tries. She's a hard worker, tries her best, wants to do well. She comes into her senior year. And, you know, her brother Craig had gone to Craig basketball, to Princeton on a basketball scholarship.
Right.
They've always made exceptions for athletes. But, and he struggled there. And he fled into the sociology department, African studies, because he would have failed out otherwise. So Michelle meets with her guidance counselor. And Joel tells the story very well, Joel Gilbert.
Yeah.
And the guidance counselor tells her, you know, you're really not cut out for the Ivy League. You know, I'm looking at your test scores, looking at your grades. You are any non-Black person with those grades wouldn't gotten past the first round of review. And and as Michelle tells the story, though,
right,
her guidance counselor, she's told this over and over again,
you know,
profiled her because she was Black and told her she wasn't up to getting into an Ivy League school. Well, Joel Gilbert did the hard work here, tracked down the guidance counselor, and she's this sweet Baptist Black lady.
I know.
Who Michelle's been able to smear all these years because, she's dead. I mean, so she can get away with it. No, Michelle, the guidance counselor told her it was exactly right. You don't belong in Princeton. I've read her senior thesis. As Christopher Hitchens once said, it was written in no known language. It's, yeah, I have
that from Joel.
My daughters could write better when they were 12, literally. And they would have known better. And her logic is horrible. She gets through Princeton, and then lo and behold, another 3 years at Harvard. Well, then from that point on, she starts failing downward. It's people who are put in positions beyond their ability do. So she goes to a big law firm. She's not cutting it. She gives some reason why, oh, I'm not suited to big law work. I want to work with people. No, right. You can't. You can take a job in City Hall after working at a top flight law school? No. At a law firm, as tolerant as they are of you because you fill their quotas, they still need you to do something. And she's not doing it. She fails downward until her husband gets elected a senator, and boom, she fails upward, you know, into a
$300,000. Yeah, and the other thing too about the Obamas. Well, you write a whole book about it, which everyone should read and read fast, because I still believe Joel's right about Michelle being the savior that comes in. But you know what would be great if they were doing what my friends, the Smiths, and all their friends that I met a couple of weeks ago in Michigan do. They encourage people that they are successful, multi-generation, upper middle class, Black families that lived life. You know, they show as the example, good families, you know, married with kids, good Christians, all of this. This whole congregation is basically all that, very successful, awesome, yeah, happy American Black families. And of course, the Obamas should be showing that. Right. Go ahead.
They should. And Michelle's parents were fun. We're good.
I know.
You know, I don't blame them for taking her out of that crappy neighborhood school and sending her, you know, 15 minutes away. I don't blame them for sending them to high schools where they could get a decent education because they weren't getting it in their neighborhood. What I do blame is Michelle for retelling the story to smear white people.
Yeah.
So she's speaking at one of those Obama Foundation forums just a couple of years ago. And the question comes up and she said, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm very close. She said, she started talking about white flight. And she said, white people moved out of our neighborhood, you know, as soon as they saw us, a respectable family, she points to herself and her brother, and just because we were Black, they objected to the color of our skin, she says, and the texture of our hair. And they started running. And then she turns to the audience and says, y'all still running, right? Total lie, total smear, right? This is a woman whose family ran for all the right reasons, for the same reason white people run, you know? And I tell her story in Untenable, my new book, of course. Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's her take on that action is the norm in liberal university academic circles.
Yep.
They're still smearing the people who left. Everyone I talked to left for a very specific reason. Either crime, schools, or both. And, you know, just like Michelle, you know, her parents left the one neighborhood. They left the neighborhood in terms of sending their kids to a better school for the same reason.
Yeah.
But only white people get smeared. And then people have had to live with this stigma for 60 years. And their children now, you know, I've always questioned, why did Dad leave? Why did they leave Newark? Blah, blah, blah. You know, why did they leave Chicago? Why did they leave Detroit? Well, I tell them why. I talk to these people.
I know.
And they'll tell you in a minute why they leave. You know,
I know my dad grew up in Camden, New Jersey. Uh-huh. The most dangerous city in the world.
It's even worse than Newark. I mean, it's...
I know, but when I was in, I think I was like in middle school, I did like a photojournalism essay and he took me. And like, yeah. I ran out of the car and took pictures of his house from where he grew up. It was all burned out. It was like, total crack. The whole street was like that. And it was hell. And you couldn't go at night or, you know, you never know what's going to happen. And then pictures of what it looked like when he was a kid and his neighbor ended up being my orthodontist. Like, so, you know, I mean, it is true, but we really have to address your book and what's in it right now. And this is a really important thing, is that the black community is so much better than the picture that is painted. And yet what we know about right now, there's a lot of encouraging, you know, defund the police and no bail, no jail. You know, they're not treated equally. But I believe, at least from what I was seeing in New York City, is that they're being very much harmed by this whole movement of supposedly to help them with all of these, all the things that have come since Black Lives Matter. It's making their lives specifically more harder, more dangerous. The parents are more, it's just everything that they've done, it seems like, since the beginning of all of this affirmative action, but now also all of this diversity, equity, and inclusion, at the end of the day, it's a backfire and it continues to be. Has it been from the very beginning? Because that's what it seems like.
Yeah, it has backfired from the minute, you know, in the whole gestalt changed in the 50s, actually into the 60s. It was a major sea change. Now, I'd like to write almost a sequel to see where that change came from. Right. But basically, we went from being a nation where individuals were expected to take care of themselves. Families were supposed to take care of families, right? So in my neighborhood, working class neighborhood, you know, I found the 1950 census from my block. And this is an ordinary block in Newark, New Jersey. There were immigrants. 50 is the most recent census that's available. They release them every 72 years. 83 families on my block, one street long, you know, very narrow street, apartment buildings, you know, the duplexes, triplexes, all kinds of buildings. 83 families, 81 of them had a married male head of household, right? 79 of the 81 had jobs. Every single job was blue collar or, right, you know, entry-level kind of clerical. So, I mean, among my favorites were casket maker, rubber molder.
Well, that's very grifter. Newark. Yeah.
Yeah, very Newark. And my all-time favorite, 79 of these guys had wives who were working. 30 of them of the 79 had working wives outside the house. My favorite one was this woman who listed herself as janitress, right? She embraces both her job and her sex, right?
Right. Well, she's, you like her. We need more
janitress, not a janitor, you know. If I had once in 1960 or 70s, by 1970, we would have gone from 81 out of 83 male heads of households to probably 6 or 5 or 4 out of 83. Okay. That's how calamitous the decline was. And when we moved to the block, it was already integrated. It stayed happily integrated for about 10 years until the 60s hit hard, you know, because of, and for a variety of reasons, but mostly the government just poured money into their idea that the system's responsible. The system will take care of you.
Right.
The system will give you welfare. The system will give you rent. The system will give you food stamps. The system will give you Medicaid. There's only one condition: get the old man out of the house, right? Right. Because if you have a married husband in the household, you're not going to be eligible for any of this.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, another thing that I remember, and I'm sure you may remember this, he was a journalist kind of like yourself. Of course, it didn't end well for his good work. Gary Webb was, I believe, murdered. I can't say for sure, but he was a journalist, for anyone that's watching that doesn't know, that found out that there was crack cocaine and other drugs being purposely put into Black communities. And I believe for him, it was in Los Angeles, some other places. Yeah. But that was a problem, too. And that was an orchestrated problem. What was that about? Was that because, you know, I mean, he went in front of the hearing, you know, he's like this white journalist. I think he was from like somewhere, Ohio or something. And he got a tip and he goes and he starts digging into this. And he's like, oh, my God, the government is pumping drugs into purposely into inner city Black communities. Of course, he spoke out. He wrote an article. His whole life blew up. He ends up suicided, as far as I'm concerned. But again, that was part of it too. And from, I don't know if they've ever recovered from that.
Well, you know, I think, actually they kind of did recover. I think Webb went too far in his inferences there. He had the CIA was running drugs. I knew a guy who got arrested for blowing the whistle on that. A guy you need to talk to sometime, Terry.
Oh, Reed, I'd love to.
Author of Compromise, Clinton, Bush and the CIA.
Ooh.
In fact, he was the consultant on the Tom Cruise movie, American Made.
I think that movie was well done for knowing. Yes. Doug Liman's a good filmmaker, but for, I think it went as close to kind of telling the truth as it could.
Right. So what was happening is, yeah, they were running drugs, but they weren't running it purposely to destroy the Black community. They were just running drugs. And it wasn't the CIA so much as the rogue operatives who were running guns into Nicaragua, then picking up drug loads because they could get away with it.
Right.
But what happened, so the crack epidemic hits New York City very hard. And this is where there's some hope if you put sensible people in charge. By during the Dinkins 4 years, like 88 to 92, New York City was averaging 2,500 homicides a year. And I remember 1 year they were complaining about taxi cab drivers won't pick up Black people. Well, in 1 year, 53 cab drivers were murdered. Okay. Right. After the 20-year reign of Giuliani and Bloomberg, who was also good on tough on crime.
Yeah, he was.
They had reduced that 2,500 a year figure to about 350. That means that you're saving 2,000 lives, the great majority of them Black or Hispanic, every year.
Yeah.
Not by, you know, these Soros kind of DAs who let anyone out on the streets, but through just hard-nosed policing and prosecuting.
Right.
And I mean, 2,000 lives a year by 20 lives, you know, that's a lot of lives.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, because that brings up something that, because a big chunk of your book is also about education. We put billions of dollars into education, especially in the inner cities. And I remember, and I kind of think that this is part of where we are now in education, right? Probably 20 years ago, it was probably around that time with Giuliani, because my first year at NYU was his first year as mayor. So I saw the change in real time in New York City from when I toured to when I was a student. So there was a big change there, but there was also something that came around called Teach for America. And they were telling everyone, I think Soros was one of the backers, that they couldn't get teachers in the inner city. So there was like a new fast track program for teachers that were willing to teach in the inner city. At the same time, we're putting billions of dollars. And if you look right now at test scores and education and everything in the inner cities, especially minority community schools, there's no explanation here as to why they're not getting educated, but they're not getting educated. Is there a correlation between all of this? Because I know your book mentions it, because it's a big deal of why people leave.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, it's interesting about education. You know, when they talk about white people in general, in a city like Newark, which is not uncommon, white people didn't see themselves as so much as white people as they did their ethnicity. So there were in Newark, there were four million political blocks in mid-century: Jews, Italians, Irish, me, and Blacks, right? They're all roughly equal in some ways. Well, Jews were totally dependent on public schools. That was their shortfall. They, you know, they came to a city where the Protestant, you know, founding fathers put a lot of emphasis on public education. Jews took advantage of it. They had some of the best schools, best high schools in the country, without being selective, because the neighborhoods were almost fully Jewish. Weakwake, Philip Roth's alma mater, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
When what happened, this is kind of involved, but in 1924, Congress cut off immigration from East and South Europe, right? So Jews and Italians were really kind of trickled in after that.
Right.
But the great migration from the South continued unabated. So this was there would be a natural replacement going on anyhow. And the Jews were most welcoming of all the ethnic groups. They were the most welcoming, the most receptive towards Blacks moving into their neighborhood. The only group that set up welcoming committees and civic groups and integration groups. And they were the quickest to leave. They were gone because they depended on the public schools
for education.
And they had such high standards that they could not afford to have 25% of their students be disruptive. They couldn't afford to have 5 or 10% of their students be disruptive.
Right.
So now you have something like 62% of all Black kids living with single parents. And in the inner cities, that number is 80, 90%. For Asians, that number is 16%.
Right.
It's the critical variable. So when they go to school together, one kid has two parents sending him off, making sure he's done his homework, prepared, ready to work. And the others are just sort of arriving. A lot of them are just disorderly and out of control. It only takes one kid to totally screw up a classroom.
Right.
The teachers, what happened in Weequake, the Jewish high school in Newark, is the good teachers, you know, they tried to hang in there, but they left. So in 1958, for instance, there's a very good ethnography written by a Columbia University professor named Shuri Ortner about her 1958 Weequake high class, just regular public school, not selected. She said there are a handful of Blacks among the 400 graduates. Something like 61% of the graduates became, she said, equivalent of one percenters, affluent, functioning, successful people. I found the 1970 Weequake yearbook. Out of the graduating class of 400 some, there were 13 white people, three of them were Jewish. In 12 years, the whole school had emptied. The teachers hung on, they tried, but they left too. And the net result was, calamitous, educational,
Yeah.
And for people with high standards, they couldn't stick it out. The Italians, on the other hand, were fighting to the bitter end,
I know. But also, they also had expectations for their children. And you want to hope that, and what's sad is that there's a lot of, I know a few single moms that kids are stuck in public schools, I know from New York, and they're doing the best they can. But what their kids are being taught is crazy. So lately, there's been a lot of Muslims that have caught on to what they're teaching their kids in school, LGBTQ plus, and the drag queen story hour. And I guess the American Library Association, a totally captured entity, put out a book list for the summer. It has like all the gay books, but also it has white fragility and all this stuff. And the Muslims have had it. So they've been going and showing up
I like that. Yeah.
Me too. But I'm sure you saw Jen Psaki on her Intel Media show came out and said that this was white Republicans manipulating Muslim communities against the schools. And that this was so, first of all, nobody's ever thought of Muslims and stupid and not able to make up their own minds. So she's saying, first of all, that, which is also the same thing with saying Black people won't achieve without affirmative action, which many white liberals did and Black wealthy liberals did too. But now she's saying that the Muslim community is being manipulated to think that there's a problem in schools that doesn't exist. I mean, the level of insulting is so outrageous.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And what you're finding now are strange alliances with conservatives, with Muslims on one hand and gays on the other hand, who are appalled by the whole trans movement, right?
Yeah.
I had lunch a couple of weeks ago with that Missouri head of Gays Against Grooming, right?
Yeah, I know one of them. Gays, she's awesome.
He said, and what's happened to them, and this is interesting, and it's probably happening to Muslims too. Once they see who their natural allies are, once they see who are the people willing to sit down and talk to them,
right?
They turn conservative. My Gays Against Grooming friend said all the leadership of Gays Against Grooming is now on the political right.
Yeah. I met a bunch of them at Turning Point. Hey, Patriot pals. So happy that you're looking into gold and silver and protecting your savings for whatever comes ahead. Beverly Hills Precious Metals is our good friend, and we've been working with them for a long time. So you'll be getting a call from them. We'll also follow up here at the Mel Kay Show because we want to make sure that you're taken care of and you're protected. If you have any questions, please let us know. Right now is the time. There's so much information coming. There's so much chaos. We just want all the Patriots out there to be sure that they are protected, they are moving forward, and that we get through the storm together and safe. Whatever may come, just know we, the people of the United States, will prevail. God wins, and protect yourself. And please get in touch with us if you have any questions. So Beverly Hills Precious Metals, they're the best. They'll be in touch. We'll be in touch. You be in touch with us. Let's do this together.
My school was completely across the board, black, white, Italian, and honestly, Jewish, Catholic, Christian. But what you're saying is more what I grew up with. People didn't identify as white. They identified as I'm Italian or I'm Irish or I'm right. I never thought that way about any of that. So, and then I went to school in New York City. So at that point, it's like, so all of this, but I was with these people, this awesome black family that grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they never thought about it either. This, and it's like they have like seven kids and they're all awesome and they all did well in life and in school. Some went this way or that way, but they have tons of friends and they never thought, they thought about it the same way, just like where they came from or whatever. But it, this really got injected as you get into in your prior books, but this book too, this is a divide and conquer as well. I mean, this is not by accident.
And you see, I was reading the Supreme Court dissent by
Sotomayor,
right?
Can you even? I mean, let's talk about it because I don't know if people went and read these, but the fact that these women are Supreme Court justices just became way more shocking and disturbing to me when I read them.
When you read it, it's like you're reading something that you would have gotten if I were teaching from a freshman composition student, and I would have sent it back for review. Her logic is ridiculous. I mean, she is arguing that, first of all, she's Puerto Rican. Let me tell you a little bit about her backstory. She grew up in a two-parent household, right? She went to Catholic school, K through 12, right? And then she goes to Princeton. She knows she doesn't belong there, right? She admits, she says, I'm an affirmative action baby. Her test scores were, you know, well below par. I don't know. Princeton, to be a little below par, at Princeton, you need to be like 95th percentile is below par. You know, you're not getting really. You look at their numbers for someone who's not racially advanced. First of all, I don't understand why Puerto Ricans got on this gravy train, right?
Don't either. I never did understand. And most of my friends growing up, we had a lot of Puerto Ricans and from all over the place, most of them were like super Christian, two parent households,
right.
Worked their butts off, were played sports. Like I didn't see this until Obama, honestly.
Right. I mean, Puerto Ricans are no more a race than Americans are a race. You know, they run the whole spectrum of colors. And
I know.
And Sotomayor is, you know, you'd say white. She's not black. I mean, that's for sure. But so anyhow, she gets into this argument that the reason that Puerto Ricans, the reason there are underrepresented groups is because of the horrific conditions, racially embedded conditions of K to 12 education. Well, she had K to 12 education in the Catholic school.
And she's that's why I was laughing at Obama and Michelle's. I'm like, what?
Yeah. So then she goes to Princeton. She never would have gotten into Princeton had she been white. Never. Wouldn't have gotten it close. And then she feels like she somehow belongs there. She never considers that person who didn't get in because she got in. And there was such a person, right? And she does well at Princeton, but yeah, I hate to say it now, you go to an Ivy League school and you are, you know, but they're afraid to fail you. They're afraid to give you a bad grade.
I know. Right? That's why they changed a lot to pass fail. When I saw that, my sister was telling me, because she's a doctor, that when they, you know, when you go on to pick your, to put in for your residency for a medical school and all of that, you have to pass all these different levels to get there and have scores. They just changed to go into residency, the test that then
the hospital that picks you for the residency judges you on to pass fail for different doctors going into frightening.
Have you had Stanley Goldfarb on your show?
No. Who's he?
He wrote a book, a very brave book. It's called Take Two Aspirins and Call Me By My Pronouns.
I should talk to him. Yes.
And I edited the book, so I know it did? Well. It was frightening reading that book.
It's so scary what they're doing. And then they're also injecting into medical school education and into getting your board certification.
Yes.
A whole litany of CRT, anti-racist.
Social justice, right.
I mean, what does that have to do with that? This is going, and here's the other thing, Jack, and this is crazy too. I want everyone to understand what happened. So the Supreme Court ruling comes down within hours. The O'Biden, I call them, the O'Biden regime puts out a memo on what they're going to do about equity and basically diversity, equity, inclusion, all of government in education. So now they're looking they're already looking for the loopholes, you know, to continue
of course,
it going.
Yeah. How do we circumvent this?
Right. Yeah. The Supreme Court. And then you had AOC out there, you know, talking about that Supreme Court justices should be removed. Meanwhile, you talked about the dissent of Mayor Sotomayor. Did you read the dissent of Ketanji Jackson?
You know, I read through hers quickly. I read Sotomayor's in some depth. I was afraid to read Jackson's.
I mean, it is, but it also cites all these things that in your book and in some of your other books too are completely not true. Oh.
Yes. What was the one about Black doctors being, well, I mean, Black women twice as likely not to have a child die because when they have a Black doctor?
I mean, there
that's
was
a crazy statistic.
Outrageous racism in her piece. And again, this was Asian students who brought the case. So
that was, in fact, it was a good thing Asian students brought the case because white students would not have had the same success bringing it at lower levels. And bless their hearts. I mean, I admire them. A good case study is Stuyvesant High School in New York City, which I don't know how they do it, but it's still test-based to get in, right?
Right.
Now, Thomas Sowell went to Stuyvesant High School.
Oh, wow.
And when he went there, he's 90 years old now. So, you know, we're talking, he entered that school 75 years ago, talking before 1950, when Blacks were allegedly, you know, discriminated against, denied all opportunity, terrible schools. But there was a much higher percentage of Blacks admitted in 1950 than there are today. The numbers declined over the years. As the numbers of broken homes increased, the numbers of admissions to Stuyvesant High School decreased. And when he was there, the predominant ethnic group at the school was Jewish, right? Which you'd expect. Now it's Chinese.
Oh, it's totally Asian, that school. Because also every single parent in New York City, if they could get their kid into Stuyvesant, they would probably cut off a limb to get
And I went to the Catholic equivalent of Stuyvesant. I went to Regis High School in New York, and it was all test-based, the only way in. When I got there were several Black students in school.
Yeah,
no one doubted why they were there. And there's not a big pool of Black Catholics in New York City. But to get in, you tested in, period. There's no other way in. Now they have some...
It's a lottery. It's a lottery. Yeah. But it's also ridiculous. And the truth is, I don't know why... Again, I believe Blacks are 13% of our country,
roughly.
And they should be, you know, all of this money. I want the Black community to ask where all the money's going. There are a lot of good parents and they get silenced by, just like with everything else. You brought up before, I saw this big climate guy that finally started questioning climate, big lefty, big progressive. You know, and he wrote like a whole thing about how the minute that he questioned a couple of the new climate things and sustainable development goal plans, like the whole thing turned on him. And now he's a far right and all this, which happened obviously to Glenn Greenwald, very out in the open, Naomi Wolf and some of these people. So the minute that they do that, and what's really going on, you know, I want to help empower Black leaders that are not being manipulated by the the still Al Sharpton's, the Black Congressional Caucus, these people, they've done nothing for the Black community. Yeah. And I don't think that they allow, like you brought up Soul, and I'm friends with Ward Connerly. He's a guy, he's good friends with Soul. They were Black conservative Republicans before that, you know, right. Of course it started that way, but he started fighting affirmative action when he was at, I think, the head of the Board of Regents of University of California. And there was a lawsuit by a white family, I think in the 80s, because their son didn't get into a medical school, and they said that it was discrimination and because of whatever. And he went and he found that it was. And that's how he started that whole journey. Yeah. But it's been hard to stay on that track for those guys. And they're still doing it.
Oh, it is, because you're always trying to sabotage your successes.
Oh, yeah. Every time.
I did a book called What's the Matter with California about 15 years or so ago. And I visited most of the campuses, the major campuses. And my rule of thumb was, the more Asians I saw, the more likely it was to be a good school.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes sense. And that's true. But I just feel like we should be, you know, I hope that some of the Black leaders that are coming out, and I see a lot of them coming out and rising up, that are taking back their community, because it's really, at this point, you dispel a lot of these myths in your book. And at this point, it's really our country, we're celebrating Independence Day. And I'm telling everyone, go read the Declaration of Independence, 27 grievances, and tell me how far we've gotten. Not so. Yeah, we need to go revisit every single one. But I really hope that maybe this is empowering, because I think a lot of people in the Black community saw the tweets and the reactions, especially of rich white liberals or very rich Hollywood Black people being like, well, now they're never going to get into college. And I hope that that's righteous indignation comes out and they say, yeah, we can, and start turning the tide.
Yeah. In fact, when I wrote Untenable, I just hold it up again.
Yes, you can hold it up as much as you want.
I wanted to, I've read a lot of books, like Heather McDonald's books and other books.
Oh, yeah, she's great. Yeah.
But I wanted to write a book that talked about people and the experience of real people. And what happens when people are subject to these experiences. And one eye-opening op-ed I read was by a woman named Leah Boustan, who is a professor at Princeton University and an award-winning scholar on the subject of white flight. And she's white, if I'm not mistaken. And it was about, she starts off by imagining how Democratic strategists must have felt in the wake of Donald Trump's victory. And they're contemplating the phenomenon. What caused it? Was it economic insecurity or was it just flat out racism, right? Those are the two options. Yeah. She says, scholars approaching white flight usually approach from that angle. Was it economic insecurity or flat out white racism, right? Those are the two poles. And so she goes through her argument, and it's relatively benign compared to the anti-racist clowns like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Abraham Kendi, and
right.
Robin DiAngelo, White Fragility, who changed her name to DiAngelo, by the way.
That's and they're recommending that to kids for summer reading at the American Academy.
Why not just hand them whips and tell them to flagellate themselves?
It's disgusting. It's disgusting.
But the what Boustan says at the end of this op-ed was, at the end of the day, there's a variety of reasons that people may have left. But it's odd that the people who did leave, white people left, never wrote about it. Maybe they didn't know. Maybe she said something like, I'm paraphrasing very close. Maybe they didn't know why they left. And I laughed out loud when I read that. I'd already spoken about 50 people, right? And they told me exactly why they left.
Right.
You
named your book Why They Left. You explained it to me when you started writing Untenable. It becomes untenable to live in that world. I hope that a lot of Black people out there find that all this nonsense has become untenable for them, because they should be empowered by what they're seeing out there. Because these people, it's like what you said earlier, too. They can't. This is an industry. It is an industry. It is a big money industry.
Total.
And people don't realize how much these people are being paid, how much they're making to write these books, to do these NGOs, to infiltrate, to keep people on welfare, to keep people homeless. These are all industries, and people don't really realize, I don't think, that there's a way bigger picture, and it's a lot of manipulation.
Mel, you're absolutely right about that. The blue-collar philosopher Eric Hoffer once said that, you know, all good causes become a movement, and then they become a business, and finally they end up as a racket. The anti-racist movement began as a racket. It was a racket from the get-go, right? Yeah. Whereas the era of institutional white racism, which existed up until the 50s, produced heroes and, you know, black heroes.
Yeah.
The era of institutional white guilt, which replaced it, it just produced opportunists and grifters and con artists. Yeah. I mean, it's a long drop off from Martin Luther King to Al Sharpton, let alone Benjamin Crump. You know?
Oh, my God. I always see him. He comes out every time.
And, or the ladies who founded Black Lives Matter, you know.
But that's what binary, I want.
The non-binary people who founded Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, but also now, you know, they say 800 million, but we're talking a couple billion, whatever they raise from Black Lives Matter. I will tell you right now, I've talked to enough Black people across this country that they're pretty pissed. They want to know where that money went, who it went to. I'll tell you where it went to, Act Blue, and electing a lot of people that are destroying their communities. But same time, you know, this is your book is really also a good read for anyone out there that just wants to see the bigger picture so they can discuss it. Because we are at a place where we have to start having real conversations with people about real things and real facts. And look, there's been an influx of books that are the opposite of yours that put out so much false information. And then we get Supreme Court justice things parroting this stuff. And it's just nonsense. And you know, I really appreciate that you wrote your book, because so many white people do buy into it or are just too scared. I've seen these photos of like these black people that are, you know, of that ilk, BLM people demanding white people get on their knees and beg forgiveness. It's like, what are you being taught on? Both sides are really sad and fake.
Right. To your point, Mel, I was, I don't think I told you about this, but I was on a debate. I was involved in a debate on reparations last month, right?
Oh, good.
And this was recorded and aired on KCPT, which is the PBS station in Kansas City.
Oh, wow.
And they had a very hard time finding a second opponent of reparations to be on the panel. They went through about a dozen people before they found the.
Why? Because they were too scared of being called racist?
That's it. That was it. And in a respectable town like Kansas City, politicians, I know, you know, corporate people, they want any place, they want to go near it. And yet I found that by just speaking honestly, and I was talking to them like I'm talking to you.
Right.
It's not that they listened, but. There were no death threats. There was no one coming after me afterwards. You know, I wasn't getting any attaboys. You know, nonetheless, it was, I found it kind of liberating, you know, where you could sit in a room with, it was a hostile audience. It was mostly white, but maybe 20% black, about 90% hostile. And then, you know, the auditorium, about 200 people. And it was a well moderated kind of debate. And then afterwards, my goal was to simply to, as the guy who ends up being with me on, he says, Jack, this is like shooting fish in a barrel, reparations debate. I said, yeah, but we can't kill the fish.
Yeah,
we can only stun them. We want to stun them into awareness, you know. We're not here to kill them, you know.
Yeah, it's so, it's disheartening, though, that we're having these conversations. I saw Cori Bush somehow in our government. Said on this Independence Day from the slavers, we should be demanding reparations more with the big, you know, and what's so scary is you and I have talked about this before, that a lot of this comes from the Weather Underground and their unbelievable power behind both Obama and the Clintons and their manipulation and all of that. I do think, though, Jack, and I'm keeping you long, but I think that they've gone, I think maybe they've pushed the envelopes of racism, anti-Semitism, you know, far right, white supremacists. way too far for the evidence, and that enough time has gone by where people are like, where are all these people?
I think you're absolutely right, Mel. The saving grace in this battle between good and evil, basically,
yes,
is that the evil guys never know when to stop. And they're working in a country where the DNA is still strong. You see that on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
80%, 90% of Americans still are proud of their country. They believe in their country. They believe in the founding premises of their country. I'm currently reading a book on George Washington. It's just so reassuring to know that, 250 years ago, there were problems.
Yeah.
There were turncoats and,
What book are you reading?
Rebels. And
what book?
We're dealing with human nature.
Right.
And we just got to fight back.
Yeah. I mean, I felt that way. I don't know which book you're reading, but that book, Washington Spies?
Yes.
I always think like that's like me and all of the people I'm around.
Right. I mean, the people who were fighting in the Revolutionary War were 3%, right?
Right. But also there were a lot of people here that were in their groups that were really working for King George. And,
right.
In their communities and all of that. So, I keep saying last thing, but you're too good to let go yet. One more thing. Seems a lot of division on the conservative side, lots of it. And not just between the Trump and the DeSantis, but then there's there's different also bigger media, Turning Point, Daily Wire, this, that. Then there's specific people, lots of division on our side right now. And not good going into 24. What's your, just before I let you go, what's your thoughts?
I agree with you. It's a total waste of energy for us to fight among ourselves.
I can't even believe it. And it's getting worse.
We have real enemies out there. We don't need to, I think once we get down the stretch, those divisions will go away. For the most part. But for now, why spend your time attacking DeSantis? Or why spend your time attacking Trump? Or, why worry about Lindsey Graham? Or, forget about all that. Keep your eye on the prize.
Right.
Keep your eye on the battle ahead of us. Don't be distracted by, I spend no time attacking people on the right.
Even I don't either.
A couple of these things.
There's no point also. And like I say, whatever's going to, but the truth is it's so bad because you and I both know the other side doesn't do that. There's no dissent basically. Now, right now, I do think RFK Jr. being over there is good for us for multiple reasons. Yeah. The biggest reason, and this is what I keep saying to people, we should be warning anyone that wants RFK Jr. to be the nominee that they better go start looking at some of the evidence of 2020 and 2022 and how that happened, because he's not a Bernie Sanders. He's not going to just walk away. I think it's a good time for at least the 30% they say that are backing RFK Jr. to start taking a look at what they before thought was totally impossible, that there was any election fraud, or they're not going to have their candidate.
Right. I think what they ought to do is look at his tweets regarding the three Supreme Court decisions. I mean, I keep wanting to warm up to RFK Jr.
No, and
he keeps
them
pulling
too.
Me back.
I know. Right, exactly. No, I feel
the
same.
I wrote an article about one. I love his position on COVID. I've read the real Anthony Fauci, He's beginning to wise up that the climate change model is the same as COVID, right? So there's no mention of climate change in his presidential, webpage, which is incredible when you think about it.
Yeah.
He's good on the border. He's good on free speech. Terrible on guns. Terrible on affirmative action.
Well, I think he's a socialist at heart, I have to be honest, when you read about him.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I think he's good for the conversation. I think that a good chunk, probably 30% of people on the left, that's thunder here. A good percent of people on the left are going to realize, oh my God, they're using the same model to destroy him that they destroyed Trump and Flynn and everyone else, because it's the same smear merchants. And at the same time, people should be looking right now that were big Bernie people and felt like they got screwed. If they are behind RFK Jr., it's time to start looking at the election and all of the stuff that people on the right have been saying since 2020. Maybe it'll affect you too. I don't know.
No, I think, even though he's 69 years old, RFK Jr. is still learning. Once the veil is pulled off,
right?
And you saw this with all those people like the Matt Taibbis and Glenn Greenwalds, once that veil is pulled back, Naomi Wolf was the most outspoken about that.
Yeah.
You begin to see that you've been lied to up and down, you know, not just on COVID, you know, not just on climate, but on everything.
Yeah, that's why I think, I mean, I see what these guys are doing. That's why I think when they steal any chance of RFK Jr. being the candidate, I hope that the people that are behind him, unlike those of Bernie Sanders, demand to know who was involved in this, because, you know, that could be a good thing too. I don't know. I feel like his voice is good, but
I like to see him out there. I agree with half the stuff he says, you know?
Right.
Which is about 90% more than I agree with most Democrats. So.
Me too. Well, Jack Cashel, let's talk one more time. Untenable is out. It's getting excellent reviews. You've been, my audience knows and loves you. So let's talk about where they can find Untenable, where they can follow Jack Cashel's amazing work regularly to help you stay sane. You should follow Jack Cashel. And so go ahead.
Well, the surest place to find it is at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You take your chances at local bookstores. I know in the metropolitan New York area, they're much heavier than they would be, say, in rural Kansas or whatever. But plus, bookstores are hesitant sometimes to stock books whose thesis they don't like, right?
Yeah.
And they're sure as heck aren't going to turn it out. You know, like, what conservative authors do when they go to bookstores, they find their book sitting this way, right?
Yeah.
And then they turn it that way.
I think it's such a good book, and so important. People need to really start. Look, we've been told so many lies. If you arm yourself with the truth, then we can have some real conversation. And I think that's awesome that you showed up to debate reparations. More people should be doing that, but more important, more people should want to be doing that.
Right. And just the only final plug for the book: it's a human interest story. It's not. There are statistics. There are arguments, but it's a story about a people, about a community, about a family. I'm on the cover of the book. I mean, it's me, it's the little guy on the right. And it is, you'll read it like you might read a novel almost, you know?
So
awesome. At least that's, you know, from my perspective, so.
Yeah, but you know, it's important. There's a lot of people who live that life over decades upon decades, including my own parents. So it's important to know, and maybe we learn something from that and carry it forward for positive purposes. So thank you.
You do a great job here. I'm always pleased to come on. Huh. It's thundering here too, by the way. So it's must be a big thunderstorm, climate change.
Yes, exactly. Oh, stop it already. You know what it is. No, but thank you, Jack Cashel. You've been a friend and a supporter from the very beginning. I'm very grateful. I believe you have a podcast too. And let's tell people about your website.
Yeah, my website is cashel.com. That'll list all my books and everything else. But it also has a refer to my podcast, which is called Upstream with Cashel and Edge. You can find it on most of the platforms. On YouTube, it's Upstream Podcast. So
great.
But it's Roy Edge, my partner, is a funny guy, a Hollywood veteran. And we talk about the culture, and he knows it from the inside. So
cool. Okay.
Plus, you can do a lot of imitations. I can't do that. So
I bet you can. You just don't do them in public.
That's about as good as I get.
Okay, you guys, Untenable, go get it. Support Jack Cashel. The book's great. You'll love it, especially, you know, if you have family that lived through it, you all know it's nice to reminisce on what was and what is and what can be. So thank you so much, sir.
Hey, Mel, thanks. Anytime.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and in light of the recent events, your continued support means everything to myself and my employees. To thank you, we're having the biggest sale ever on all my pillow bedding. Get MyPillow bed sheets for as low as $29.98, a set of pillowcases for only $9.98. In this economy, instead of buying a new bed, rejuvenate your bed with a MyPillow mattress topper for as low as $99.99. We also have blankets in a variety of sizes, colors, and styles, like plush, waffle, or gossamer, for as low as $29.98. We even have pet blankets from small size to the ones for your car. Get huge discounts on duvets, quilts, down comforters, and so much more. So go to MyPillow.com or call that number on your screen. Use your promo code and you'll get huge discounts on all MyPillow bedding, including MyPillow bed sheets, for as low as $29.98. Get all your shopping in while quantities last. Please order now.
Hello, Patriot Pals. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about our amazing partner, Mel K Superfoods. A lot of people do the food prep programs that they come in, you know, freeze-dried and all of that. This is not that. This is a full serving of fruits and vegetables and protein. It is a way to maintain a healthy diet, no matter what you're doing, no matter where you are, no matter what happens in this country, because again, it's very affordable. And at the same time, it's very easy to follow. And it is like having a full garden outside your house that you're going and picking fresh fruit and fresh vegetables every single day. You have that same nutrients inside your cupboard. You know, prepare now, be ready. A lot of people do prepping stuff. This is an excellent way to prep to make sure that you and your family always have the essential nutrients that you need to live a healthy, full life out there. Please check out Mel K Superfoods. We're loving the program. We'd love for you to join us. Please get in touch with the show if you're having benefits from the Superfoods program at Mel K Superfoods. We'd love to hear from you. Go to MelKSuperfoods.com and join me in supercharging our wellness journey and living our best, healthiest lives ahead.